And another happy Thanksgiving to everyone listening in today. Thank you very much for being with us today as I talk with Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County, former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. He's senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. And I think he's there. Are you there? Noel, are you with us? Let's see. Oh, let's see. Hold on. Noel, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, there you are. How are you? Happy Thanksgiving.
Well, same to you and to all of our listeners out there.
Well, I really appreciate you being with us. Bill Volkert with us as well, wildlife educator and naturalist with the DNR's Bureau of Wildlife Management at the Horicon Marsh. Bill, happy Thanksgiving.
Good morning, and happy Thanksgiving to you as well.
I tell you what, I know we always get lots of calls. This is always a great show, a fun show to do, and I'm really looking forward to talking about a whole variety of things. You can join in, by the way, if you have a question, at 1-800-642-1234, or if you're in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and with your comments. And I guess, Bill, you know, we could hardly start out the show without talking a little bit about turkeys here on Thanksgiving Day. And the wild turkey population is doing really great in Wisconsin.
Well, it's back again, that's for sure. Interesting history with the wild turkey. It was a bird that really wasn't that common in Wisconsin in early settlement days, except in the far southeast and southwestern part of our state. The range was indicated to be somewhere between, say, south of a line from Green Bay to La Crosse. And so turkeys were, you know, say, at the far northern edge of the range in Wisconsin, and with settlements coming on and quick changes to the land and unregulated hunting, we lost the turkeys from the state by about the 1880s. There were some reports around the Mississippi River into the early 1890s, and that was essentially it. The causes were probably then the habitat loss from over-harvesting of the oak trees in particular as a food crop and habitats, unregulated hunting, and perhaps diseases brought in with domestic poultry. But a combination of things led to their demise, and a couple of attempts were made to bring them back, including an early one in the 1920s and 30s. That never really took off too well. That was near Sauk County area. And then again, the Meadow Valley Nisida Wildlife Refuge area in the 1950s, turkeys were released. But those birds came from New York, Pennsylvania area, and were semi-domesticated birds. They took off for a while. They showed some promise. They topped out at about 3,000 birds. It was looking good. Harsh weather and a couple of hard winters in there really knocked that population out. And essentially, the population began to dwindle quickly, and Wisconsin was all but ready to give up on turkeys at that point. It just didn't seem to prove itself. And then Iowa showed some tremendous promise in the 70s in the eastern part of the state. They were getting their birds out of Missouri. This was a full wild strain bird, and we think that that was probably one of the other problems, is that we didn't have the right genetic stock of bird. So 1976. We got turkeys out of Missouri, and in fact, we didn't buy them from Missouri. We traded them, and we figured, I don't know who came up with the calculation, but it was 3 grouse for every turkey. And in fact, we were at a low point in our grouse population. It took us a couple of years, so to speak, to pay off our debt. We let them go in that southwestern part of the state, and they just established themselves very successfully and were increasing the population tremendously every year. And we began to help them with their spread by essentially baiting them in winter, bringing them into basically a little corn pile, and then using rocket nets to capture a proportionate flock, box them up, drive them to new release sites, and let them go.
Well, it's a great thing, and I can tell you, driving back from Bayfield last weekend, I saw lots of turkeys way far north of that line that you were talking about, Green Bay and so forth.
They're right up to almost to the Lake Superior shore these days, and just about everywhere except that far northeastern part of our state where we've got the heavy forests and really kind of a sparseness of the oak trees and the hard winters. They're farther north than they've ever been known to be, and no doubt agriculture and our mild winters have certainly been a benefit to the turkey population. Estimates are we're probably over 400,000 turkeys nowadays. And so not only successfully reestablished, but doing better than ever.
Well, let's take some calls, guys. We've got Robin online from Platteville who's been waiting. Robin, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, and happy Thanksgiving.
To you as well.
We have a crazy cardinal, a female, who sits on top of the feeder post and then dives at our sunroom window. And she just goes back and forth to the window all morning long. Then she flies off for a while and comes back again and does it some more. Sometimes a male will come and watch her, and it's almost as if he says to us, I don't know what she's doing.
Well, Bill Volker, I'm Noel Conrad. Let's go to you. Noel, what is she doing?
She's seeing the reflection of herself in the window, and cardinals are one of the species where the female also sings, so they're quite concerned about other females being in a territory. Usually that drive to evict other females drops off this time of year, and that's why you can have, you know, large numbers of both male and female cardinals at your feeder, because now they're not showing any kind of territoriality, and they will tolerate other females or males quite nicely. I had a female for the first time here in my office in Port Washington that flew against the windows off and on for about 4 months, which I thought was a quite long period of time. It was all the way into the fall, so
yeah.
Maybe some of these birds, because their hormones are persisting later into the year and causes them to want to drive out other females, and of course, when she sees her reflection in the window, she thinks that's another female and wants to get rid of it.
Yeah. Thank you, Robin.
We
appreciate the call. Let's go to Mike in Castle Rock next. Mike, hello to you.
Good morning. I've had several flocks of evening grosbeaks here, which I've never had at the feeder before, and also a red-breasted nuthatch, which I typically see every maybe 2 or 3 years. What I haven't seen in a very long time are brown creepers. Anyway, that's the report here.
Okay.
All right. Well, what do you think, Noel?
Yeah, I can take that one, too. It's interesting that evening grosbeaks are one of those species of in a breeding abundance. They're increasing a little bit in the state. They're not very common at all, and they're just restricted to the few far northern counties. But in the wintertime, we have seen a significant decline of evening grosbeaks in Wisconsin and other upper Midwestern states now for a couple of decades. We used to have good numbers of evening grosbeaks in the state every year, but now I haven't even, I know my son hasn't seen an evening grosbeak in Wisconsin this year. I saw a couple way up north during June during the breeding season, but it is getting very, very hard now to find evening grosbeaks in the state in the wintertime, and we're really not sure why. Of course, evening grosbeaks and other winter populations are, we can monitor what's happening to these populations through counts like the Christmas bird count coming up soon. And also the great backyard bird count that happens in February. And the data from both those counts show that evening grosbeaks have been greatly reduced. You mentioned red-breasted nuthatches. This is a good year for them. There are a lot of reports of red-breasteds moving down into the southern part of the state this fall. They tend to kind of have a 2, maybe 3-year cycle sometimes where you'll be very few in 1 year and good numbers the next year. And this appears to be a good red-breasted nuthatch year. Brown creepers, they're kind of hard to predict. They're not very common in the wintertime in Wisconsin, and they're pretty inconspicuous. We don't see them very much. They creep up and down the trees, as their name implies, looking for insects and eggs and pupa and larvae in the bark crevices of the tree. But there should be a number. I haven't heard any reason why they should be down in number, so maybe it's just your particular area where you're for some reason,
happen to
creepers
be.
Are not appearing.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Jessica in Summit, it's your turn next. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, how are you? Happy Thanksgiving. And we're always thankful for the neat birds that we get here. And I have a question. We had former gansers. I thought they were buffleheads, but saw them in the binoculars. They were more gansers, and they were being followed by a big bird. And I don't know if it was a seabird or if it was just a tern, but it was almost like he was directing them or fishing behind them. We've also had a juvenile bald eagle, which was a big deal. Our neighbor across the way thought maybe it was an osprey, but we're pretty certain that it was a juvenile bald eagle. So those are two kind of neat things that we've had recently here.
Oh, that's great. And Bill, a comment from you?
Well, I'm just curious about the bird that was following the mergansers. Was it on the water? Another
it
bird?
Was on. Yes, it was on the water, and it sat very high. It was a large bird. It was you know, I didn't know if it was a tern or a seabird. It had white with brown speckles and a long beak, and it looked like the beak had sort of like a break in it, which I looked up and I, you know, found the northern fulmar. I'm doubting that's what it was, but that kind of was like what the beak looked like with a, you know, I don't have the greatest binoculars, so I wasn't able to identify what color the beak was.
Yeah, we're not going to get fulmar here. Jaeger is a possibility.
Okay.
They're around on the Great Lakes on occasion. Also, while you mentioned the beak, though, it doesn't look gull-like, but we've got a variety of different gulls, and we also get an influx of them in the wintertime. And there's also various plumages among gulls for young ones, and it takes them several years to attain those adult plumages. So that's a real confusing group as well. It may have just been association, not that he was, you know, in any way, say, fishing or taking advantage of it. But there's always that possibility, too.
Yeah.
You know, gulls are attracted sometimes to mergansers diving for fish because they're always hoping for a free handout. And sometimes they'll hang around and try to pick up some fish that come to the surface or maybe an injured fish. So sometimes they'll associate with mergansers.
Thanks, Jessica.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Christine in Evansville, it's your turn next. Hi, Christine.
Hi, good morning, and happy Thanksgiving.
To you as well.
Well, I live in Evansville, and this morning, just right in my driveway getting into the car, I heard a lot of crane bugling. And I guess my question is, how long do they stay around for the season?
Uh-huh. Thanksgiving is a big time for movement, it seems. We tend to get the early of the movement of the cranes heading out of the state in October, we'll start to see them really flocking up in September, October. And some of them will take advantage of those winds and weather systems in October. But I commonly see them moving around Thanksgiving, the end of November, even into early December. And it doesn't seem like a bird that should stick around that late in the year, but they're feeding in the grain fields. And so... there's always food available for them. Southern Wisconsin got some snow last night, so that's going to make it a little bit more difficult to search for food. And most of our cranes are going to southern Georgia and north central Florida. That's where our flock ends up.
All right.
Yeah, there was a report yesterday around the spring green area where they approximately 1,500 to 2,000 cranes in corn stubble. So we still have some very sizable flocks nearby, and I believe there's a good number out in the Goose Pond area in Dane County.
Horicon Marsh also, we've been holding some large numbers, and every day you see them going in and out just like the geese. They feed up in the uplands and rest on the marsh and some of the drier sites in the evening, and they've still been good, quite abundant. But I'm sure that with some of these colder winds here, a little bit of snow cover, that's starting to force them out.
Thanks a lot for calling, Christine. Appreciate your call very much. Noel Cutright, one of our guests today, senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. Bill Volkert, the other guest, naturalist with the Department of Natural Resources based in Horicon Marsh. I'm Larry Mueller. Keisha Mabra, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking the birds of Wisconsin and the birds of, well, elsewhere, anywhere else. As a matter of fact, if you have a question, maybe you saw a bird that you want to ask about, or maybe just a question about birds, a particular species, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And also email us at talk@wpr.org. And we have a couple open lines, so we can get you on pretty rapidly here. So let's go back to the phones and Maggie in Oshkosh. Maggie, hi to you.
Hi. I have a question about what I think is a kestrel, but my son, who is the birder in our family, swears to Pete that it is a peregrine falcon. We saw the bird at our dog park. We see red tails all the time at the dog park, I think because the dogs scare up a lot of the shrews and the bunnies and all that kind of stuff. Easy prey. But this bird came across white belly, yellow feet, and slate blue feathers. Just beautiful bird. Not very big. Maybe a little, maybe about the same size as a good size red tail. And I'm having a fit because I think it's a kestrel. My son's having a fit because he thinks it's a peregrine. But I haven't seen any, I haven't heard about any peregrines being this far. I know they had some in Milwaukee, but I haven't heard of peregrines being up here near Oshkosh. Can you make a stab in the dark?
Well, let's try both. Noel, we'll start with you.
What have you considered about it being a Cooper's hawk?
No. Hang on, let me look it up.
Well, we're
sitting here with our bird book out. Is that the slate blue feathers?
Well, on their back, they all have, it's definitely a gray feathering, both the male and female adult, whereas the juvenile is brown with streaking in the front.
Okay.
They're certainly one of the more common hawks that we see these days. Their population's rebounded quite nicely, and they're quite common. You very often see them gliding and flying across the landscape fairly low because they're hunting birds, which is their primary prey.
Okay.
And, you know, they're not as large as a red tail, but they have short, rounded wings, a pretty long tail. And they
skim really close to the ground?
They will skim close to the ground because they're hoping to surprise a bird that's in a brush pile or around a feeder situation in a housing area. Kestrels tend to perch on wires or on tall structures and just wait till they see something and fly down and try to catch it.
Okay.
But sometimes you'll see them hovering in the area, searching for prey underneath. Peregrines, unlikely, even though it's certainly possible, they would, in the Oshkosh area this time of year, they'd probably just be passing through or moving around. There's no resident pair in Oshkosh, even though there are some in the Fox Valley breeding in the summertime. So I'm guessing it might be a Cooper's. A females are larger than males, and they can get pretty good size.
Do they have the white tummy or the speckled tummy?
Well, they can have, it's kind of streaked, but it would appear, if you just saw it flying across, it would appear pretty light-colored.
Pretty light-colored.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My son's having a fit because it still counts in his bird book because we've never seen a Cooper's hawk before. So, but this is, the only thing that we are having the discrepancy about is it's got a yellow, what we saw had a yellow-tipped beak. Do Cooper's hawks have, the picture that we've got is great, but it's not... It doesn't really show the beak?
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's probably a dark color, but it could be some lightness on it, too.
Okay.
Beak color really is typically not very important in trying to identify a raptor species anyway.
Okay.
Okay, fabulous. It sounds like a Cooper's hawk. Thank you so much. We're both wrong.
Thanks, Maggie. Thanks a lot for calling. Well, let's go to Therese in Green Bay. Find out what's on Therese's mind. Hi.
Good morning. Happy Thanksgiving.
To you as well.
This is a great tradition.
I love this tradition, too.
My question is on bald eagles. There's a nesting pair near me at the Brown County Fairgrounds. What do they, I know they need to eat during the winter, but do they fly back and forth from their nesting grounds, or what do I expect? Where do I look for them?
Bill Volkert, what do you think?
Well, this
and I'll
year...
hang up and take my answer offline. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Well, this time of year... keep in mind that we're way past the nesting season, and those birds are no longer tied to a nesting territory. So the eagles that we'll see at this time of year could be resident or local birds that are just remaining in the area, or it could be birds that have even moved in from further north. And the eagles are, of course, fishermen, so to speak, in large parts, so open water will certainly keep them around, but they're also known to be scavengers. So they will take a variety of different prey. Out at Horicon Marsh, we usually pick up a fair number of them during the Christmas bird count, and we're finding if there's open water, they may fish that, but we're usually frozen up by that time of year, and they're harassing the geese and looking for cripples in among the flock and easy-to-catch ones. A healthy goose is obviously almost impossible for an eagle to get, but those that are having problems out there are usually picked off by the eagles, and they'll hang around a little while. If you're really looking to see eagles, watch for open water, and some of the traditional great spots have been along the lower portion of the Wisconsin River, the Mississippi River, especially below the dams when we have hard winters, and also the Kaukauna area along the Fox River, another spot where they'll hang out for fishing. Seems that most of our eagles will either hang out in southern Wisconsin in those open water areas, especially in mild winters, and others moving down toward Missouri as a wintering site.
Thank you very much for calling. Ida in St. Paul, we go to you next. Hi, Ida.
Hi, I'm not in St. Paul. I'm actually in Kenosha.
Okay.
I'm from St. Paul.
Okay.
We're just as your program came on, it was very exciting. We were just south of Milwaukee by the Racine Line, and on the side of the road in a barren, you know, tree limb, there was this huge bird, which I thought was a owl, otherwise it was some sort of raptor, but I only saw the back and we were flying by, and it was sort of grayish or brownish feathers on the back, fluff, and then in the front was lighter, you know, brownish or light though, or grayish, but huge, just huge. And I was wondering, would it be possible? I don't think I've ever seen an owl that I know of in the wild. Would it be possible that it could have been an owl?
Well, Noah, what do you think?
It's possible, but unlikely this time of day. Here in Port, it's really cleared off, and the sun is shining now, and usually this time of day, owls are going to be secreted away in a roost situation, so they're usually not going to be sitting out where you can find them. But sometimes, you know, deer hunters may have flushed one out of the woods, and it may have perched temporarily anyway along a roadside in a tree. But it's more likely to be a red-tailed hawk. They commonly perch very out in an open area, quite visible from a highway.
I don't know. We're from Minnesota, and I'm not so great on birds. But I'm not so knowledgeable. But aren't the red tails, we see them a lot on the light poles?
They'll perch on light poles some, but very often in a tree.
Oh, this was much larger, I think. This was huge. This was absolutely huge. It wasn't an eagle or anything.
Well, there's really nothing between the size of an eagle and a red-tailed. Of course, rough-legged hawks also, but they're about the same size when they're perched as a red-tailed hawk. So there's really nothing in between a bald eagle. And, of course, they're not going to be light in front, whereas a red-tail, when it's facing you, that the white belly and chest area is going to be pretty visible to you.
Yeah. Thanks for calling.
Appreciate
the call, Ida.
And, you know, every once in a while I do see red tails, and, you know, the females tend to run larger than the males, and some of those look extremely big. And so there's some variation among size within it. Every once in a while there's some large red tails out there among the flocks.
And, you know, especially if you're closer to the bird, I mean, if the bird happens to be right next to the road, and you know, you're used to seeing it a little further away.
And on a cool day like this, they'll billow up those feathers a little bit and a little more insulation, so they'll look a little bit larger. I was doing the same darn thing in a tree stand earlier this morning.
Mike in Rice Lake, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Yes, good morning. When you mentioned about eagles being scavengers, my favorite place, I deliver newspapers in the morning, and I quite often see eagles out there on deer carcasses that have been hit.
Oh, absolutely. Deer carcasses, and occasionally where you may have, in, say, wintertime, young cows or livestock that go down, they may be just thrown out in the field. I've seen that before where they're on it. In fact, as long as we started talking about turkeys, I think a lot of people probably remember that Ben Franklin didn't want to have the bald eagle as their national symbol and wanted the turkey. And his reason was that he thought that, sure, the eagle, bald eagle, is a powerful bird, but being a scavenger, it wasn't the, at least in part of its habit, it wasn't the most, say, best qualities for it or characteristics, and he rejected the bird for that reason. Well, we got it anyhow. He was overruled.
Okay.
And a significant source of mortality, bald eagles are being struck by cars along roadsides where they're feeding on carcasses, and they just get in the way of the cars passing by.
And with all those deer carcasses out there, that's a heck of a food source for them and everything else, too.
Yeah, I was driving back myself from on Highway 27 north of Hayward last Sunday, and there was an eagle, couldn't have been 5 feet off the road, dining on a Carkill deer carcass, so they're out there, but it would seem to pose some hazards for the eagles, for sure. Katie in Chicago, it is your turn. Hi, Katie.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
We are driving from Chicago to Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Right now, we're outside of Milwaukee.
Okay.
And I was just wondering what birds, you know, we might expect to see on this route.
Okay.
And also on our way back from Oshkosh to Chicago tomorrow.
Okay. Well, Noel, we'll start with you.
Well, we've already talked about red-tailed hawks perching on trees and poles and signs along the highway that they should be pretty visible today. So you definitely should see some red-tails, maybe kestrels also perched on wires or hunting in the median strip or along the grass rights-of-way. Keep an eye open, too, for things like swans, and we already talked about sandhill cranes. There has been some movement today. And tundra swans are also moving down from areas in Alaska where they're breeding down to the wintering grounds more toward the Chesapeake Bay, and they fly diagonally across the state. So just keep an eye peeled for flocks of, I guess, sandhill cranes, tundra swans, and even Canada geese.
Yeah, I saw quite a few Canada geese driving into the radio station this morning. Well, I'll tell you what, we have some open lines. We're going to Katie next, but you can join us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. In the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Talking with Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County and senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, and Bill Volkert of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He works out of Horicon Marsh. And give us a call, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. And now let's turn to Kate in Elk Mound. Kate, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I actually have another raptor question for you.
Okay.
The other day I was hanging around the house and heard a large thud coming from one of our windows and went outside and saw a small raptor laying on our deck. And at first I thought it was a sharp-shinned hawk, but I looked closer at it and it had chocolate brown eyes. And it was about that same size, but I looked it up and I believe it was a merlin, a female merlin. And I put it up on the railing so it was away from stray cats or whatever, but and it recovered and took off. But I was just wondering, I looked up in the bird book, and it said it's an uncommon species in Wisconsin. And I was wondering if that's true and if you know anything about the population status in the state.
Okay. Bill, any ideas?
Well, the merlin is a mid-sized falcon. And when we had the question earlier about the peregrine kestrel and sounds more like a Cooper's hawk, the first thing to look at would be the wing. The falcons have long pointed wings where the excipitor hawks, the sharp-shinned Coopers, have the short rounded wings. So that's a really good clue. Merlin is the mid-size falcon, a little bigger than our kestrel, looks kind of like a heavy-bodied kestrel, and they tend to be very dark. They nest in the spruce forest of Canada, and also northern Wisconsin has them nesting, and that's the population seems to be increasing up there. Now, it is uncommon. It's not a large population, and it's very widespread as they start moving through Wisconsin on their way south. Pretty good sightings are along the Lake Michigan shore. Oftentimes they'll follow that, and people can sight them and pick them up there on occasion. Otherwise, inland, it is completely random finding a merlin here or there. We've had them stick around into the wintertime occasionally. Others, the majority of them seem to just pass through toward more of the southern states.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And Kyle in Belgium, your turn. Hi, Kyle.
Hello, guys.
Hi.
I haven't yet gotten the Atlas, but I really think I need to. So, therefore, I have a couple questions for
okay.
everyone. First, what's the earliest you've heard great horned owl call for the breeding season? And second, what's the population status on yellow-headed blackbird, maybe statewide?
Okay, Noel?
Well, great horned owls, you can hear them just about any time of year. They're going to start to nest here in February, so it's not that far off. I was out early in the morning here a couple of times this past week, and I could hear great horned owls calling from my house. So it's definitely possible to hear them, and during Christmas bird counts, people will get up early in the morning or stay out after dark and listen for great horned owls to try to add them to the count. So they're pretty commonly calling this time of year. As far as yellow-headed blackbirds, I believe they're increasing slightly in Wisconsin, but overall there's not a real significant trend in populations of them. Certainly here in the eastern part of the state, the best place to view them is probably along Highway 49 at Horicon. There's a sizable population of yellow-headeds there, so you have a good chance of trying to find one because it's such a beautiful bird, and we pay so much attention to red-winged blackbirds because they're so common, but if people have a chance to see the yellow-headed, it's a great one to see. But I think for the most part, their population trend here in Wisconsin is pretty flat, or meaning it has a stable population.
Well, I think they're also limited in habitat. It's a deep water marsh specialist, and Wisconsin's the only place east of the Mississippi River where you're going to find the yellow-headed blackbird. And so places like Horicon Marsh and similar large marshes, the backwaters of the Mississippi, they're very punctuated on the land where you're going to find them. And they're semi-colonial, so if you find one, you usually see a loose colony of them, and then you can drive miles without seeing any of them. So I think they're probably restricted just on the available habitat we even have for them.
Mm. And Kyle mentioned the Breeding Bird Atlas. So I'm going to ask Bill, because Noel can be modest sometimes. What do you think of that Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas?
Well, it's been a tremendous contribution to ornithology. And the book is essentially the result of 6 years of field study trying to confirm the nesting status of all the birds that actually breed in Wisconsin. And that's important because we want to know just what is Wisconsin important to in terms of not just birds that pass through or visit here for our enjoyment, but where we are actually supporting those populations for maintaining their numbers each year. And with that, you'll get a really nice idea of the distribution of where these birds are nesting in different parts of the state. Some real surprises that with enough eyes out there and so many people, literally an army of bird watchers helping us to collect the data, things that I think surprised just about everybody of how common some of these birds were or widespread. You know, we don't always get to all those little places to find them unless you make a concerted effort. Yeah. And with that, it's also a baseline data. It tells us that at that point in time, in the 1990s, of what we had at that point, which means if we try to do this again with a similar protocol, and the attempt is about every 20 years, that we now have an idea to be able to track the trends of what's changing of those birds. How are they doing over time? Otherwise, the problem is we're always using different methodologies as we have more people, more eyes, and we're trying to guess, well, how are these birds doing? Well, we don't always have complete data that we began with. You know, a lot of this is anecdotal and very limited. So it was a really good statewide coverage and a very important contribution to our knowledge of the status of birds.
Absolutely.
One thing I won't be modest about, Larry, if I can interject here,
sure,
is that we still have copies for sale.
Good.
And Christmas is coming up, and you're available going in to visit the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology website. We have a new website address, by the way. It's www.wsobirds.org. And you can go into that and check on, click on the WSO bookstore, and you can go to the selection of books that we have available. And I think the Atlas book will be right at the top of the list. So they're still available, and it'd be a great Christmas present for the bird lovers out there.
And it's wsobirds.org.
Correct.
Okay. All right, let's go to Darlene in Mount Horeb next. Darlene, hi to you.
Hello, good morning.
Morning.
I actually have a question about some birds farther north. I was talking to my sister about a week ago. She lives near Stratford, and she was telling me about two unusual birds that she saw in her yard. One she thought she had identified as a northern shrike. She said it kind of came and took out or knocked off a big woodpecker off the feeder. And the second bird was what she said was an albino goldfinch. It wasn't truly albino because it had the distinctive black feathers, and it had some yellow on its head, so she could tell it was a goldfinch. But she said it was, the rest of it was white, and I wondered how unusual those were.
Hmm. No?
Not that unusual. There's a number of species that you can see white feathers or partial albinoism in them. There was a picture posted this week on the Wisburden listserv that showed a partial albino pine grosbeak, and it was one of the most beautiful birds I've ever seen. Beneath our feeder right now, we have a junco that has typically white in its tail, but this has several feathers that are all white, and it really stands out among the other juncos. So seeing a goldfinch with some white feathers, different patterns on them, it wouldn't be all that uncommon, but it's kind of nice to have one you can give a name or keep track of, because usually you can't tell one goldfinch from another, so it's kind of hard to keep track of them during the year. Northern shrikes, this is a bird that preys upon insects when it can, but of course this time of year it can't, so it's forced to look for meadow voles and other kinds of small mammals, but they also feed upon small birds. And there's been a number of northern shrikes in the state this year, throughout the state, all the way into Milwaukee County, but I know there's good resident populations now in the wintertime up in the Ashland area, so you can find northern shrikes spread out throughout the state.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks, Darlene.
Thank you.
And on to Leslie. By the way, you can join in. We have open lines again, finally, so you can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. We'll be glad to get you on pretty quickly. Leslie in Woodruff, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you.
I have an embarrassing situation. I can recognize a lot of the birds I see traveling all over northern Wisconsin, but I'm woefully ignorant in being able to identify which black birds I am seeing, especially on the roadside. And I wonder if your guests might help me out a little bit.
All right. Leslie's voice was a little bit low there, but she's interested in identifying the black birds that she sees along the roadsides and wonders what identifying characteristics they might have that would help her out. And Bill Volker, maybe I'll turn to you first.
Okay. Well, blackbirds, there's the true family of what we call the blackbirds, the red-winged blackbird, yellow-headed blackbird, and I guess there are overall just black birds, certainly crows and even starlings. People sometimes will lump the starling in with it, though it is a non-native bird and an entirely separate family. Of our native blackbirds, red-winged blackbirds, you've got the females, which look quite distinct from the male, and also first-year males. You're going to see that speckling and blotchiness among those first-year males, and on the wing, rather than that brilliant reddish-orange color, it'll be a more of a yellow. So you have to wait for them to open that wing a little bit or watch the body feathering. The grackle is certainly common enough. It's got that large, stout beak, a much longer beak than the other blackbirds, and that very large tail with the purplish iridescence around the head and in the breast. We have two others that are oftentimes a little more difficult for people to identify, and you've got to get a close look, and that is the rusty blackbird and Brewer's blackbird. Rusty blackbird nests up in the Canadian spruce forests, and we get good numbers of them coming through starting late September, October. Just heard one the other day yet outside in amongst a mixed flock of blackbirds. They've got a very distinct call, and this is one way I always pick them up. They love to sit up high in the trees in the roost sites and perch sites that they'll take. And the call is a two- or three-note, kind of a squeaky or squeakly. There's a real distinct accent. It's a little squeaky-type note to it. And it gets its name from this rust color that you'll see. So you need binoculars, either close range or a scope, to really take a close look at it. But you'll see that rusty-type sheen to it. The Brewer's blackbird is a prairie bird. We have some nesting in central Wisconsin. They're mostly coming down from west of the Mississippi River. We get some nice flocks around Horicon Marsh and some of that open agricultural landscape. And this is a bird that, to me, looks very much like the red-winged blackbird. But so it doesn't have that long tail of the grackle or stout bill, a sort of mid-sized bird. But you'll notice just a little bit of iridescence of a greenish to purplish color right along the neck. And, of course, the lacking of any wing marking. So those are those you got to watch for, and they will mix.
Now,
the brown-headed cowbird, of course, is in that family as well.
Mm-hmm.
Are you seeing them this time of year, Leslie, or are you talking about more of the summertime?
We lost Leslie.
Okay. I was just going to mention that this time of year up in Woodruff, there's not going to be that many blackbirds, as Bill described, that are still hanging around. So you're probably almost restricted to the starling, which he mentioned, which is not all that common up in the Woodruff area this time in the wintertime. Of course, the two most conspicuous blackbirds in color this time of year are the American crow and the common northern raven.
Northern raven, yeah. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We're talking birds today with Noel Cutright, senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, and Bill Volkert, wildlife educator and naturalist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources based at Horicon Marsh. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking the birds of Wisconsin and the birds of everywhere, as a matter of fact, with our two guests, Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. Thanks for listening in today. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Vern in Appleton is next, so let's go to Vern. Hi, Vern.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Oh, you're welcome. Talking about the yellow-headed blackbird, I had a friend years ago that lived at Oshkosh. He lived just a little bit west of town, south of Lake Mutimore. And he had seven would come into his feeder every day. That was the only time I've ever seen him or even heard of him around here.
Wow.
But they were absolutely beautiful.
They are a beautiful bird, aren't they, Noel?
Yeah, and when you do have feeders out, they will fly in from the cattail marshes, as Bill mentioned. They're a deep water marsh bird that really prefer large.
See, they weren't far from the edge of the lake, which is marshy.
Right. Yeah. They will fly in and use feeders, especially when they get here first in the spring. But even during the breeding season, they'll take advantage of those feeders, and they are a glorious bird.
Hey, could I ask a question?
Sure.
How do you tell a difference between a crow and a raven?
Okay.
Well, I'm glad you asked, because I was going to get into that discussion with Leslie if she'd still been on, because I wasn't sure what size of a blackbird she was seeing. They're a little bit difficult at times. Two of the main field marks you need to see is try to look at the tail, because the raven will have a wedged-shaped tail, whereas the crow will be pretty much straight across. And if you get a look at the head, or especially the beak, the raven has a big, really large beak for its size. And of course, overall, it is a larger size bird. So size, tail shape, and size of bill would be the three main distinguishing characteristics, especially when you're just driving along the roadside and see one fly up from the roadside or fly across the road.
Also, calls are very distinct.
Yes,
crow has that cawing. You'll hear this bawk. It's a bad imitation, I realize.
Well, that wasn't bad.
It's more of a raspy gurgle almost to it, unlike the cawing of the crow. And that's also very distinct among them.
Yes.
So if they're vocalizing up in the North Woods, listen to that.
Could I ask one more question?
All right.
Can I shoot starlings?
Okay, the way the laws are written is that all native birds are protected under the International Migratory Bird Treaty Act. So, in other words, all birds are protected in North America, and even when we have a hunting season, essentially the hunting season, which is posted in the Federal Registry, is an exemption to that. In other words, it allows you to go out and take ducks and geese at certain time of the year under those regulations. About 3 years ago, they passed the Migratory Bird Treaty Reform Act, which was a reinforcement of this, and it said this, that Migratory Bird Treaty Act protects native birds, not non-native birds. So in other words, birds that can be taken then are the starling, house sparrow, and pigeon. And, of course, that's only where discharge of firearm is even legal. And with starlings, I always caution people, be really careful, because even grackles, red-winged blackbirds, and so forth, those are native birds, even the brown-headed cowbird, and by federal law, cannot be shot. So do be careful if you try some population control. I realize starlings can be extremely aggressive and unnerving around feeders. It is a non-native bird and a competitor for a lot of ours, but if you're going to take that action, do be careful.
All right. Thanks, Vern, for calling. I want to give Andy a chance in Door County. Andy, hello to you.
Hello. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Bird report and a quick question. We've seen, a lot of turkeys around Bailey's Harbor. Also a lot of bald eagles, Sturgeon Bay, Jacksonport, in Bailey's Harbor. But earlier in the summer, for about 3 weeks, we had a flock of about 5 white pelicans hanging around Bailey's Harbor, which was pretty interesting. But the question we want to know is, when can we expect to start seeing snow buntings?
Snow buntings. When would you start seeing those?
Well, a month or so ago. It seemed like we started seeing them actually in October this year. Lapland longspurs, which are another field bird that come down in the wintertime and very often are associated with snow buntings, we actually saw some of those in September this year, but right now there's both Lapland longspurs and snow buntings in Wisconsin. I've heard of a few large flocks, but it seems like when they first come down in the fall or early part of the winter season, they're in smaller flocks. But as the winter goes on, it seems like some of these smaller flocks coalesce into large flocks. So you should be seeing them. We actually saw some along the Lake Michigan shoreline in Milwaukee County, Ozaukee County, Sheboygan County. This is late November, probably 3 or 4 weeks ago. So it's definitely time to start looking for them in the open fields, the open habitat areas in Door County.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. 1-800-642-1234, the number to call. Kay in Sauk City, you're next. Hi, Kay.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yes, to you.
I have a question about the great horned owl.
Kay?
We live pretty much on the edge of town in Sauk City. We've got the river. We've got some acreage around us, undisturbed woods, farmlands, and we always have great horned owls. Now, this summer was an odd year. From dusk until dawn, these owls were literally circling our house. We'd go out at dusk, and we'd see one in the tree in the field across the street, and then a couple of them in the field behind us and to the side of us, and even hanging in a tree over our driveway and on top of our TV antenna. And they screeched all night long. It wasn't the lovely hoot. It was that squeal, that screeching. And it wasn't until early October when it got cold that we finally got a good night's sleep. What was this phenomena? Are these adults? Are they juveniles? Hmm. Was it just a banner year for great horned owls?
You sure they were great horned owls?
Judging by the size of them, yes. Because I could stand on my stoop and I would watch them fly out of the tree on the,
okay,
on the driveway.
Well, Bill, yeah. Volkert, what do you think?
Well, it sounds like great horned owls, and it sounds like they had a bumper crop this year. Great horned owls, like many of our owls, Noel mentioned earlier, they nest very early in the year, and they never know what kind of a season they're going to have. So they'll lay a good number of eggs, say 3 to 4 eggs or so, and commonly not all of them make it. And so in a sense, it's kind of an insurance policy. And you'll actually see, because they incubate so early in the year, they have to sit on the eggs right away, so they hatch at different times. And commonly, the older ones will kill the young ones. If there's enough food coming to the nest, and they're all doing well, if you've got a really good rodent here, they all survive. It sounds like you had a pretty big clutch, essentially, that they did quite well as one family. Those young ones will beg from the parents well into the fall time, and sometimes right here into November. They're fully independent at this point. They can do well. They're just hanging on. And that screech or begging call they do, it can be a little unnerving. I've had a number of people ask me about it, and if it's a different bird. Those are the young ones, and you'll hear this. Let me try again. It's kind of a... this is sort of just begging call. It's a little kind of a, as I say, almost a little unnerving type of call, and they will go on and on with that throughout the night. They're fully grown at that point, considering that they hatch out so early in the year. They're entirely independent, but... Oh, just like some kids, you know, they seem to hang on forever until the parents finally drive them out, and now they disperse for the winter time to find their own territory, and now the parents will eventually start hooting as we get in December, January, as they set up their territory for the next nesting. So these are just young ones that are just hangers-on, and it'll go through late summer and well into the fall.
All right.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Kay, for calling. Appreciate it. And Nate in Summit. I believe it's your turn. Hi, Nate.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a question. I was out last weekend on Silver Lake in the town of Summit, and I saw a very large bird, larger than any bird I'd ever seen, and it was kind of a dark brown. I was looking through the binoculars with white dapples, like white markings all over it, pretty much from tail to, you know, on the underside of the wings is what I saw a lot of, and I wasn't sure. We opened up our bird book, and it looked like exactly like the picture of a juvenile bald eagle, and I had never seen a bald eagle out there before and wasn't sure if that maybe what it was, and if so, would it be leaving shortly and heading back maybe to a river or a flowage that wouldn't freeze up during winter, and I just wasn't sure if they would leave then and
mm-hmm.
If they migrate at all or not.
Okay. And Noel?
Yeah, I kind of had a little bit of a hard time hearing that, but definitely I would say it was probably a bald eagle. It takes them a few years to attain their full adult plumage, so they go through a series of plumage changes from, you know, the first year juvenile is really pretty dark, you know, they'll have some whitish on it. As it gets into the second year, it gets more white, mottling and speckling in the back and the wings and in the chest area. Even in the third year, it'll be pretty much the same. So you'll get a combination of plumages, mix of brown feathers and whitish feathers in the wing throughout the body all the way from the juvenile bird all the way up till they start developing the white tail, the white head, like in the fourth year. So, and they do migrate, as Bill mentioned, this time of year nesting is all done, but they're hanging around primarily areas where they can catch or scavenge fish. So you're talking about the larger water bodies of rivers and lakes in the state. But there are still birds around in the north woods living off deer carcasses, as we mentioned earlier. So as the winter comes on, the lakes start to freeze up. Fish becomes more difficult to find in open water areas. They'll move down along the Mississippi primarily, but very often will stay below reservoirs where there's dams and open water along the Wisconsin River, another favored location for them to spend the winter.
Also keep in mind that for the last 2 years, we've been in excess of 1,000 nesting pair of bald eagles in Wisconsin. They've made an incredible comeback. And so with that, there's good production of young and good possibility of sighting these much more difficult to identify immature birds.
Great. Awesome answer, guys. You guys have an amazing wealth of knowledge, and we're so lucky to have you here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I agree. We are lucky to have them. Nate, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's see. Tom and Ozaki, I believe. You have a question.
Hi. I had a question about hunting birds. I know what hawks and eagles and stuff look like, but there's some smaller birds, and once in a while you'll be driving down the road and you'll see them up in a wire. Or else I've noticed a couple coming around by my bird feeder, and it's maybe a foot long with maybe a 14-inch wingspan. It's kind of a creamy color almost, and when it flies, it kind of, the wings almost look like they flop a little bit, but it's a good flyer. But what's the name of a bird like that?
No?
Good question. I'm not sure exactly what you're describing.
The wings are kind of thin looking as you see them overhead.
And where are you seeing them again?
Around my bird feeder a little bit.
In Ozaki. I tell you what, we'll have you guys ponder that. And we will be taking a break here, but we'll be back with our two guests, Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, in just a minute. Stay with us. We're talking everything about birds now with our two guests, Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. Larry Mueller here. Noel is a current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, senior editor. Bill Volkert, wildlife educator, naturalist with the Department of Natural Resources, stationed at Horicon Marsh. Really pleased to have them both with us. And you can join in if you have a question. Is there a bird that you've seen, you wonder what it is, or maybe there's a behavior that you're interested in wondering and knowing about? We hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And we've got open lines. We can get you on right away. And I tell you what, we had a caller who wondered about a bird he had seen. Bill Volker, it was about a foot long.
Yeah, and, you know, as he was talking about it, he said he sees it on along the highway in his backyard. I don't know if it's always the exact same species, but he said perched on wires. To me, the first thing that came to mind would be kestrel, what used to be called the sparrowhawk. That smallest of our falcon, he's got that sort of almost a coppery color or orangish color on its back, but not that common around the feeders. It's not unknown, but usually not a backyard bird. As we've been talking earlier, one of the more common birds of prey at the feeders these days are the Cooper's hawks, and these are birds that ambush and try to catch the small birds on fly. And the problem with these birds is that because they're chasing down their prey, they're oftentimes hard to get a close look at because they're not always perched readily where we get a good look at them. We oftentimes see them in flight, and those can be challenging.
Yeah, they sure can. Well, I tell you what, we have Lisa online from Clear Lake, so let's go to Lisa next. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Larry.
Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for the show.
What can we do for you?
Well, I live in a little bit of a rural area, and this spring there was a pair of indigo buntings around my farm.
Indigo buntings around your farm, okay.
Yeah, and I think they made it. I didn't see any babies, but I'm wondering what they eat. Are they making a comeback? I don't know.
Okay, what's the status of the indigo bunting, Noel?
Well, there are species that breeds in Wisconsin. They're a neotropical migrant, typically over winter far south of Wisconsin, arrive back usually around the 1st of May. They tend to like edges, shrubby areas between open areas and woods especially, or in shrubby fields. So, I would expect them back. They're invertebrate eaters during the breeding season, primarily. So you're talking about insects and other small insect-like critters. And there's no reason to think they won't be back. The populations are doing well in Wisconsin. And you can find them breeding in just about every county, probably in every county here in the state.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Lisa. Appreciate it. Michelle in Pleasant Valley, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. I have read about feeding hummingbirds, and I've read in two different books. One book said that you should stop feeding hummingbirds in the fall so that they will fly to where they need to go for the winter. And then another book, which sounded very reasonable, but the other book then said, you should continue feeding hummingbirds so that they have the energy, the source of food, so they can get where they need to go. Now, both sound reasonable, but which one should I do?
Well, Bill, what do you think?
Well, this is a little bit of a difference of opinion, as just as we hear different opinions about keeping open water as a bird bath for birds through the winter time, and there may be different opinions, but on this one, we will have sightings of hummingbirds into October, even November. We had some in the early December. Those are birds that are not being held back, apparently, by available food. And what it seems is really the whole impetus for migration is physiological changes with the shortening of the day length. Those birds that have failed to leave have done so because of some sort of problem, whether there's an illness, weakness of the bird, or some reason it just never got into that migratory mode. In other words, keeping food there is not what kept him from leaving. It's only keeping him alive a little bit longer, and if they hadn't left by the time we're into this point of the year, they're probably never going to get into the kind of condition they need. And so these late sightings are usually birds that end up perishing on us. So keeping the food out there is not holding them back, and they'll leave on their own. So with that, no, go right ahead. Keep it out there as long as they're taking advantage of it. When nature tells them it's time to go, they'll pick up and go in spite of the food. Those that fail to, they're being weeded out of the population, so to speak. Probably something else in terms of poor health there.
Okay. Well, that makes sense.
All right. Thanks, Michelle, for calling. Valerie in Green Lake, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Val.
Hi. I guess I've been seeing these birds that look like black ducks, and I don't know what they are.
With a white beak?
They have
I don't know if they're white. They might be yellow.
Hmm.
Yeah, with an ivory-colored beak, so not a pure white. Probably coot, the American coot.
Oh, okay.
It's a flocking bird on the water. They're vegetarians in large part. They tend to form some pretty big flocks where you've got a good aquatic vegetation, and that's a bird that mingles in among ducks, and it's commonly confused. It's not a true duck at all. In fact, it's a distant relative of the cranes. In the rail family.
Yeah, and if you see them in the water, if it's cold, they'll a lot of times be bundled right together very closely.
And when they're swimming, you'll see that head bobbing like a chicken. And that's kind of an unusual behavior. But they're all slate blackish with that off-white bill, kind of ivory-colored.
Okay. That could be.
Is that what you're seeing?
I bet you that's them.
All right. Thanks, Val. Thank you very much for calling. And Robin in Eau Claire, it's your turn now. Hi, Robin.
Oh, thank you. Well, I took ornithology in college, and it was like one of my favorite classes. So I just thought I would ask you, how can you keep the birds from attacking your siding, like the woodpeckers or whatever else you have trying to get at your house?
Yeah. Well, who wants to take that one? Noel, do you want to try that one?
Well, it's certainly one of the more difficult issues that homeowners, especially those with cedar siding, have to face at times.
Yeah.
It seems like some people get along with no problems whatsoever by woodpeckers, and others are just driven to distraction because of the damage that woodpeckers can do on the siding. There's a number of methods that have been tried. Some find them certain ones very successful, others will go through several without really finding much relief. University of Wisconsin Extension has an excellent bulletin, I believe, put out by Scott Craven, who is very often on Larry's show.
Yep.
And also Cornell University's website has an excellent discussion of woodpeckers and how to try to control the damage they can do on siding. So I would refer you to those two publications, both of which you can obtain through the web.
Do you have a name of Scott Craven's publications?
If you go to the University of Wisconsin Extension and go to their publications unit, you will see the bulletins are separated out according to various classifications, and I believe one of them is wildlife. Yeah, and you go to that, and you'll see Scott Craven has authored several books or several of those publications. But they're usually pretty descriptive. I don't know I don't know the exact title, but it'll be something that...
I think it's called Controlling Woodpecker Damage.
Ah.
I know that was an early version of it, and I think that as it's updated, I think that's still what it goes by.
Yeah.
You know, I found that they don't really like auto body cement. They don't appreciate the taste of...
No, so you put that in the holes?
Oh, yeah.
No?
Well, the problem is that they may just start new holes, and one of the real challenges here is that if you can try to break them that habit early, just like the cardinal we had at the beginning of the program, fluttering against the window, this kind of disturbance, and just they're not going to get over the habit that they have. You just have to keep them away.
Hi.
The challenge, however, is that most of us work during the day, and when they're busy, we can't be there to break them that habit really easily. But some sort of distractions or something, a number of different things you can try.
Yeah.
Pound on the walls?
You can try that. Mylar strips that flutter in the wind.
Mylar?
Yeah, that the sort of a glossy type of plastic. That may work. Pinwheels, I've heard people trying. You know, you can use a number of different things that you can get out there and try to somehow as a scarecrow or scare tactic or disturbance the bird to keep them off. If you can be around all day long while they're there, you might be able to break them of the habit. But that's the real challenge. You've got to be almost as persistent as they are.
Exactly.
Okay, good luck, Robin.
Thank you. Sighting.
Good luck. And it's nice to have a someone named Robin calling our bird show today. That's great. June in Vilas County, it's your turn. Hi, June.
Good morning. I just wanted to ask the gentleman how many reports of turkeys they have seen in Vilas. I saw two of them along Highway 70 west of St. Germain several weeks ago, and I couldn't believe my eyes.
Vilas County. And Bill Volkert, there are turkeys in Vilas County.
They're getting into that area, but again, as we get into that heavier, more mixed pine and spruce forest, that's not really the good food for them. They need the oak trees. And so with some of the agriculture that takes place in northern Wisconsin, some of those openings and the mixed oaks, that's pretty good for them. You mentioned earlier up toward Bayfield County. They're in the northern Wisconsin, but it gets a little tougher for them with the hard, long winter and the lack of food. And in that far northeastern part of the state is pretty restrictive for them. I think you're right at that northern edge as we see it today, and that's why there's just a few of them here and there, not the big flocks that people are more common to, say, in the southern part of the state.
Oh. Thanks, June, for calling. Appreciate it. Joan in Pewaukee, your turn. Hi, Joan.
Good morning, or afternoon.
Afternoon.
I have a sock feeder on my balcony with finch food in it, and the other day I looked out and there was a downy woodpecker sitting on it eating like mad, and I was wondering what he was looking for.
Well, downy woodpeckers will definitely eat seeds. I mean,
they
love, well, they won't love, but they definitely will feed upon sunflowers as red-bellied and the other woodpeckers also.
Uh-huh.
Even though if you have suet out, that's going to be the preferred food for the woodpeckers, but they will eat seeds also.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, that's good to know.
All right.
Okay,
thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Joan. And on to Dave in Stevens Point. Dave, hello.
Howdy. I just, the lady that was looking for solutions with her woodpecker problems, what we've done, do I still have you?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, great. What we've done, I live up north of Lake Tomahawk, and we feed the woodpeckers. I just take a log and drill great big holes in it and put suet in there, and they leave the house alone. Or you can put with cedar siding, I just put a piece of cedar siding up against, you know, nailed it up there, just for them to hammer on that, and then I can take it back down and replace it when it gets ruined.
and they do that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they'll start to, I mean, if there's easier food there with a nice feeder, that, you know,
they'll take that.
Ignore your house.
That makes good sense, doesn't it, Bill?
Well, it may or may not work. Actually, I had the opposite problem. I had to take down my suet feeders because I think I was baiting them in, and they were wrapping my house. I've got several hundred little holes in the siding of our house. I've just learned to live with it, I guess. We'll re-side it sometime in the future. Once in a while, I'll hear them tapping, and I'll bang on the wall from the inside and try to break them that habit before they get going. But you know, I'm not here all day either, so every once in a while I'll walk around and see new holes here and there. So I try not to bait them in with the food. And I don't know. Everything's a different situation with these birds. You know, one person may have a lot of woodpeckers, nice cedar siding, and no problem. Next person, they're drilling the whole house up.
Now we've got Phileateds up there, and they're the I mean, it sounds like a construction zone in the house. So I try to, you know, they're going to be there anyway. So I figure if they're going to be there, I might as well give them something good for them.
And, oh, you bet.
They're good.
Thanks, Dave.
You betcha.
Thanks very much for calling. Dave mentioned Pileated. I think I mentioned on the show one other time we were at Peninsula State Park this past summer, and we're just fortunate enough to come on a family of four pileated woodpeckers all together, and my wife Renee got some nice pictures.
Oh, fantastic. That's always a rare sight.
That's a rare sight to see four of them at, together. Anyway, that's what I thought anyway. And let's take some more calls. Mary Ann, I believe, is next in Iron County. Mary Ann, hi to you.
Oh, hi, Larry. I live actually on the Turtle Flambeau Flowage, and I'm calling because I was interested in the lady. She said she lived in Vilas County, and she saw a few turkeys. Well, we have had flocks of them along. they went ahead and they put a new road in over here by us. And I'm telling you, I bet you I saw 40 or 50 of them this summer. And I haven't any idea how they're going to survive, but we've had a lot of birds up here. They must have heard about the new road and all the seed that was going along the highway, the little road here. So just for your information, I thought I'd call in.
Oh, thanks, Mary Ann, for calling. Appreciate it. And, well, that's kind of nice news, isn't it, Noel?
Yes, it is. It's such a wonderful bird to look at and to watch, and it's great that citizens now in most of the counties are able to view them.
Yeah, absolutely. You can join in, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. We'll get you on pretty quickly here as we talk with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert about everything about birds. And Rebecca in Platteville is next. So let's go to Rebecca. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. Okay, I am very saddened and I'm feeling very bereft. I cannot hear or see whippoorwills. I go up to the cottage around Wautoma, Wisconsin, in Washera, and used to hear them on the lake all the time. And every now and then, because they were secretive, and you'd find them. Ugly little bird, but what the heck. Anyway, I don't hear them, don't see them. And down here where I live, they used to hear them in the woods. I don't hear them.
Well, maybe both Bill and Noel. Bill, you want to comment?
That is a bird that is in trouble. Populations have been declining for some time, and we don't really know what the cause is. It is a true tropical migrant. You know, they're going well to the south. We don't know if there are problems down there, if it's changes perhaps in the nesting ground here in the upper Midwest. They're a ground nesting bird. Is there something that they're a little more vulnerable to? I'm really not sure. They usually tend to be in the deeper part of the forest, fragmentation, high numbers of raccoons and predators. Maybe that's an impact. We haven't been able to put our finger on it, but, yeah, that's worrisome. There's a bird that would just go on all night with that incredible singing of it.
Yes!
And it's becoming silent in the woods.
Yeah, that's too bad. Thanks, Rebecca.
Thank you.
I appreciate the call very much. I wonder, I mentioned earlier that 3 winters ago, the great horned owl and some other Canadian owls showed up in Wisconsin in big numbers. Any sign that we might see them again this winter? Bill, a comment from you?
Well, what we had was just this incredible invasion, and the reason that it was so noteworthy was not only the large numbers and variety of owls, the great gray owl, boreal owls, hawk owls, birds that normally just stay up in that Canadian spruce forest and rarely will venture south. There seemed to be just a widespread crash in the rodent prey, and that's what was really unusual. And there's a number of different rodents they feed on, and a lot of these do have cyclic populations. So we all know about lemmings, but even our meadow vole here has a 4-year population cycle. But it seems that with a variety of different prey items like this, the different species of rodents, somebody's usually in a pretty good number so they can shift back and forth. For some reason, it's like somebody just pulled the rug out from the bottom of that whole population of rodents, and they were just bailing out of Canada. It's astounding that those birds can get by at 20, 30, 40 below in those harsh Canadian winters as long as there's food, not the cold weather. Or there's no food, there's this invasion, and I think that's what made it so noteworthy, is this was exceptional.
Yeah.
And who knows when that'll happen again,
yeah.
At least to that degree.
Yeah, I know there there's something relating to so several species of finches, Bill, reports out of Canada. I guess there was a poor year for pine cones? Or?
Right. right. We've been getting reports for the bird watchers from the foresters up in Canada, and the spruce, the fir trees seem not to have done very well, and that oftentimes means good news for the bird watchers here, because what we have is, with a lack of food, just like the big owls, some of these little songbirds can remain through the dead of winter in Canada, except when you get poor food production. So it seemed that among some of those different trees in that boreal or spruce forest of Canada did not do well, and with that, it may bode well for us as a pretty good invasion of some of the finches. The evening grosbeak we talked about earlier, purple finches are more regular, pine siskins, red poles, watch for some of these birds, maybe even the crossbills or pine grosbeaks. These are things that are always a great thrill to see in the backyard, and I think that's why we feed them, for not only helping out the common birds and enjoying them, but all of those surprises that happen every few years.
Yeah, absolutely. Noel, I know the Christmas bird counts are coming up. Can you give us some background on how people can volunteer for that?
Yes, they are. The season starts here not very far off. It runs from December the 14th to January 5th, and we have around 100 counts will be done during that period here in Wisconsin. And so there's just a count just not that far away from where we all live. And I would encourage people to participate when they can. The best place to find out information on where these are located is the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology's website, which I gave earlier at www.wsobirds.org. And click on research and then click on Christmas bird counts. And there's a map that shows the locations of all these circles and also a listing of locations, counties, who the compilers are, their phone, email addresses, and where people have provided the information, actually the date that these various counts will be held. So it's a way for the listeners to try to tap in and help in this citizen science count that's been going on for over 100 years.
Over 100 years, and the dates are a little different. They're not all. It's not all the same day.
That's correct. You can. Well, my son and I we're signed up to do about 10 of them so far this year.
Boy.
So we're going to have lots of fun here starting in a couple of weeks.
Bill, are you going to be on your list?
Do I have what?
Kettle Marine is on your list?
I think there's a conflict. I don't have a date for it, and someone might have zipped me out. They gave me a bigger treats this year, Bill.
Okay. Well, that's one of the problems is that it's such a so many counts and such a kind of exciting event, but there's a very small window, and now we're ending up with conflicts. For those bird watchers who want to get out and try to do some of the traditional ones and help on a new one, there's only about 2.5 weeks' time, and it's quite a rush to get out there and do enough of them.
Well, I tell you what, it's a great experience, a great thing for people to do, and I hope, again, where do they go again, Noel?
Go to www.wsobirds.org, and one of the areas you can click on is research over on the left-hand side of the website, and then under research, click on Christmas bird counts, and you'll go to all the information that you need.
Well, I'll tell you what, Noel and Bill, happy Thanksgiving to you. Thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Well, thanks always for having us on.
Always a pleasure. I'm going home and watching my red poles, siskin, and purple finches that are coming to my feeder right now.
All right, great. Thanks. Noel Cutright, former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, senior editor of the Wisconsin Bird Breeding Atlas. Bill Volkert, wildlife educator and naturalist with the Department of Natural Resources. He's based at Horicon Marsh. And, you know, while we were doing the show today, I had my young daughter, Emily, sitting in with me, and she's now sitting right on my lap. And, Emily, can you tell everybody how old you are?
4!
Well, you don't have to say it quite that loud. 4 years old, and what do you want to say to people today?
Happy Thanksgiving!
Happy Thanksgiving to you, honey, and happy Thanksgiving to you. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back tomorrow. We've got Garden Talk. We've got our Vicars of Vegetables coming by tomorrow. UW-Madison professors Irwin Goldman and Jim Nienhuis will be with us to talk. Well, we'll give you some gardening haikus and do some other things, too. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.